Okay, I am going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Friday, April 12th, 2024. Present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Co-Chair Representative Edgman, myself, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Ortiz and Representative Colombe. And before we start, just a reminder, if folks can mute their cell phones. We have two bills this afternoon. We will hear a public testimony on House Bill 219. That is repeal assistive technology loan program. Also review the fiscal note, and we had no amendments, and so we can move that bill out if it is the will of the committee. Also, we've got Representative Tomaszewski here with us. And then the second bill will be an introductory hearing on Senate Bill 170, that is extending senior benefits. And so this is the first hearing on the bill, and we'll hear the bill and set it aside. So first up, House Bill 219, Repeal Assistive Technology Loan Program. And I will ask Representative Dan Sadler if he could please come to the table. If you could put yourself on the record online. We also have his staff, Melody Wiltredink. And also would like to note that we have with us Representative Kronk. So with that, Representative Sadler, if you could please put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Dan Sadler, House District 24, Chugiak, Birchwood, Eagle River, Peters Creek, and Thunderbird Falls. I appreciate the chance to be before the Finance Committee with House Bill 219, which is to repeal the Assistive Technology Loan Fund. Mr. Chairman, just kind of to briefly reset the stage for us, the purpose of this legislation is to allow to write off into the sunset a well-intentioned loan program that was instituted many years ago but has not had its intended use. My intent is to end this assistive technology loan fund and to appropriate the money to a nonprofit that can actually make the grants and use the fund for the purpose for which it was intended, which is to assist disabled Alaskans with disabilities in obtaining assistive technology, that allows them to live and work and go to school in Alaska. There is a two-step process required to implement the intent of this language. The bill, the first is to appropriate the approximately $446,000 remaining in that fund to the Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Senior Disability Service, Vocational Rehabilitation, Special Projects section. And that was actually executed in passage or will be in final passage of our operating budget. But that is contingent on passage of HB 218, which technically repeals the fund. So that is what is before us today, is the repeal of HB 218. I do have my staff online, Melody Wiltredink, to answer any technical questions, but I appreciate the chance to bring this forward. Thank you, sir.
Great. Thank you very much. Maybe if we could first, so that was a brief recap of the bill. We've already had its first hearing. And I'd like to go to, well, actually, it's not that complicated of a bill, so we'll go ahead and go into questions, and then we'll do public testimony. And so with that, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, I got 219, and so I think Rep. Sadler referred to it as 218, and I'm just making sure are we on 219?
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, you are correct. For the record, it is 219. It's been a long week, and my numerology is beginning to fail me. 219.
And I'm never clear, Mr. Chair, what officially on the record has to be accurate to hold things. And
that's it.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony, and folks who are watching online and who would like to submit written testimony can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. I've got a number of people here who are listed as yes for public testimony, but I'm not sure if they are here for public testimony. They might just be available for questions. David, Christian in the room, are you here for public testimony?
David Christian, I'm with the Department of Labor.
I think you're just here for questions, answer questions. Okay, thank you. Okay, so next we'll go to Jamie. I'm not sure how to say your last name. Jamie, if you can put yourself on the record. And I says you're here for public testimony also, but you might be questions. Jamie, if you could put yourself on the record.
Sure, thank you. I imagine you're talking. This is Jamie Kokoska, and to the chairs and members of the committee, my name is Jamie Kokoska, and I'm a program coordinator too with the Alaska Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. And we thank Representative Sadler for bringing forth this bill and Representative Fields and Armstrong for their co-sponsorship. The council, along with the Statewide Independent Living Council, also called the SILC, presented their position paper in support of the recommendations from the Alaska Division of Vocational Rehabilitation and the Assistive Technology of Alaska, which we call ATLA. We believe that assistive technology is critical for Alaskans with disabilities to live a healthy, productive, independent, and dignified life, and assistive technology allows them to participate in education, the labor market, and leading a civic life. The need for assistive technology has only increased as the internet and other technologies have become indispensable to accessing services and participating in work and community. The council believes that ATLA is the best organization to take over the remaining funds of the restricted Title I funding. It aligns with ATLA's current AT Act services, which can include developing new programs that adhere to AT Act requirements. And also, ATLA has a proven track record of responsibly managing the funding for this purpose and getting assistive technology into the hands of Alaskans that need it. There is more information about why this bill is needed in our position paper. And just something I want to point out is the individual that's on the photo of that paper is one of our staff members, and he is using a one-handed keyboard. Thank you so much for your time and consideration of this bill. If you have any further questions or need information, please contact our executive director, Patrick Reinhardt.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Kokoska. And would also like to note that Representative Stapp joined us earlier as well. And just a reminder, if folks would like to send in public testimony by email, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. Misty Rail, if you're online, if you can state your name and your affiliation.
Yes, for the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Misty Rail, and I am the Executive Director of Assistive Technology of Alaska, or ATLA, and I am here to answer any questions or provide any further information for the membership.
Great, thank you. Okay, seeing no one in the audience, and I believe there is nobody else online, I will go ahead and close public testimony on HB 219. And do we have any further questions for the sponsor or staff, Representative Cologne? Then after that, we'll go to the fiscal notes. Representative Cologne.
Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Rep. Sadler. Just a couple questions. I think there we addressed this, but I'm trying to remember. On the Finance Committee question answers that you gave us, one of them said that the fund was avoided being swept because it consists of federal funds. And on the last question, it ends with earnings on the fund are restricted. So I guess my question is, have you found any issues with moving this money since it has federal funds and we're not sure where the interest is the interest allowed to be used for this?
And thank you through the chair, Representative Cologne. We have been soaking in this question for a while and have, because the origins of the fund are kind of lost in the mists of time, I can't give you a clear answer. I cannot cite a federal chapter and verse, but I think the evidence that over 20 years and more that has not been swept is going to be kind of tertiary evidence that it's not sweepable. I think had money been available in our days of fiscal challenges, it would have been swept. It has not. So I'm going to take that as evidence that it's not sweepable. The best answer I can give you, ma'am, is that it is restricted funds and cannot be. It's not sweepable.
Follow up. Yeah. So I guess my question was through the chair to Rep. Sadler, because there's federal funds, is there an issue with doing what you want to do with this money? That was my question.
And to answer that through the chair, I guess I'm going to call my lifeline Mr. Mays, Dwayne Mays, who has probably been with the division longer than most of us have been around and probably has the best historical knowledge, and he might be best able to answer that question. If Mr. Mays is online?
I don't see a Mr. Mays online. Are you online, Mr. Mays? I do not see.
In that case, I will go down my list and ask if my staff, Melody Wilterding, might take a swing at it.
Ms. Wilterding, if you can put yourself on the record.
Hi, yes, thank you, Chair Foster and members of the committee. For the record, sorry, I've got a baby. For the record, this is Melody Wilterding, staff to Representative Dan Sadler. And yes, I actually do have the answer for that question. So the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation got into touch with the appropriate department of the federal government, and they have given its approval for the funds to be moved to the nonprofit Assistive Technology of Alaska. So we have approval from the federal government for this move to actually achieve the original purpose of the funds.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we've also got Mr. David Christian, who might want to add to that. Mr. Christian, if you can put yourself on the record.
Certainly. For the record, my name is David Christian. I'm the Administrative Operations Manager for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development Division of Vocational Rehabilitation in Juneau. The Assistive Technology Grant Fund has, that body has given us authorization to transfer those funds to Assistive Technology of Alaska.
Thank you. Further questions?
No.
Okay. I don't see any further questions, so we'll jump over to the fiscal note. And with that, Mr. Christian, if you can walk us through that.
Thank you. House Bill 219, repeal assistive technology loan program. The assistive technology loan fund was established in 1997 with federal seeds from the Assistive Technology Federal Grant. The program allowed for loans from a commercial bank to be made to qualified individuals for assistive technology equipment. The fund has not been utilized since 2014 and is no longer used by the department. This bill would make these funds available to a non-state entity, specifically the Assistive Technology of Alaska, aka ATLA, in providing assistive technology equipment to Alaskans with disabilities. I would like to add that this is a zero fiscal note. This bill does not modify a fund, and it does not affect any regulations.
Okay, do we have any questions on the fiscal notes? Representative Galvin?
Thank you. I do have a question, and pardon me if it's already here. I just now am looking at it. My question is, knowing that this is a loan fund, I mean, the way it was originally set up, have any loans that have up to this point already been cleared? And if there is more that's owed that may stream in, what happens with that?
Certainly, and through the chair, Representative Galvin, there are no existing loans. The last loan, I believe, was 2014 and was paid off in 2018 or 2019.
Follow up.
So including that loan, just to make sure, there will be no further payments on any loans coming in because they are all clear.
Correct. And to specify... this fund was used to guarantee the loans through the commercial bank, so there has not been any funds that have gone to that for the loan.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Seeing no further questions, we did not receive any amendments on this bill. And if it is the will of the committee, I would entertain a motion. Representative Co-Chair Edgemond.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move House Bill 219/LS0718/B from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. And hearing no objection, House Bill 219, which is 33-LS0718/B, is moved from House Finance with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. And if we could have the paper to sign. And Representative Sadler, any parting words?
Express my appreciation to you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for this.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Christian.
Thank you all.
And so we're going to jump right into the next bill. I believe the Senate is still on the House, on the Senate floor. So is Senator Kawasaki's trustee staff. If you'd like to come up, we have next Senate Bill 170, that's extending senior benefits. and repealing the longevity bonus. And I'd like to ask Senator Kawasaki's staff, which is Griffin. I might have to have you pronounce your last name here. And also, we don't have you on here, but I know Mr. Chris Hayes is also in front of us. Joe Hayes. And thank you. I was just looking at the former speakers of the building, too, which you've also got that namesake. But anyway, and if you could both put yourself on the record. We also have Deb Etheridge, Director of Public Assistance, available for questions. And let's see, Deb is in the room. So with that, if you could both put yourself on the record.
Thank you. Through the chair for the record, Griffin Sukeo, staff to Senator Kawasaki. Like the chairman said, the Senate floor is still going on, so Senator Kawasaki could not join us today. But I will be going through the sponsor statement, then the sectional, and do a little background before opening it up to questions and whatnot. So to begin, the sponsor statement, Senate Bill 170 would extend the senior benefits program indefinitely, ensuring continued support for low-income seniors across Alaska. The successor to the longevity bonus created in 1972, the senior benefits program would end in June of 2024 without legislative action. The senior benefits program protects low-income seniors by providing them with modest monthly cash assistance to pay for expenses like food, heating, electricity, transportation, and prescription medication. The program was established in 2007 and currently aids over 10,000 Alaskans age 65 and older with incomes at 75, 100, and 175% of the federal poverty level. Subject to appropriation from the Alaska State Legislature, assistance can range from $76 to $250 a month for eligible seniors. In September of 2017, the House Health and Social Services Committee held a statewide listening session for senior benefit recipients and their advocates. Hundreds of Alaskans spoke of the need to preserve this program to enhance their way of life. This program protects seniors who have spent a lifetime building our great state. It lends a hand to low-income seniors who need assistance to make ends meet. Terminating this program would put thousands of seniors at risk of losing their means for maintaining a healthy lifestyle, and I respectfully request your support to continue this vital program. If it pleases the chair, I will move on to the sectional analysis.
Okay.
The sectional analysis is as follows. Section 1 repeals the existing statutes that establish the longevity bonus program. It hasn't been funded in a very long time, and the senior benefits program does its duties. And then Section 5 removes the sunset provision for the senior benefits program. This makes the program permanent and no longer needing periodic legislative reauthorization.
Mr. Hayes, did you have any comments?
Through the chair, Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki. I'm just up here to answer any questions also.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, questions of the committee? Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Appreciate this bill. I've had many elders in this state, and some of whom have appreciated this piece and it really has made a difference. But I am curious to know, in looking at the senior benefits program fact sheet, it does mention one piece that made me question it, and that is not the program at large, but just this one stipulation: payments are not available to seniors living in the following institutions. And it does mention, it says prisoner jail, Alaska Pioneers Home and Veterans Home and Nursing Home. And then it says public or private institution for mental illness. The top three I understand, because I would guess they are not those seniors we assume are being fed, have supports in terms of activities and supports in terms of a warm, safe place and access to health care. The last one I'm a little bit tripped up on because I'm curious. It says a public or private institution for mental disease. I'm not sure how that's defined, and I'm not sure what if an elder is in a home for some other reasons. Maybe it's a disability or some other thing, and I just wanted to ask for more clarity on that.
Is that Mr. Suko, is that, or how do you say their last name? Sorry.
Be the chair, Sukao.
Sukao, thank you.
sorry. Through the chair to Rep. Galvin, I'm going to defer that question to Deb Etheridge.
Ms. Etheridge, if you can put yourself on the record.
Hello. For the record, my name is Deb Etheridge. I'm the director for the Division of Public Assistance, and through the chair, Representative Galvin. I think the terminology is a little antiquated, but it generally refers to, for example, a state institution such as Alaska Psychiatric Institute or a facility that might be specifically for individuals with developmental disability, but it is an institution versus a home, which I think I need to clarify.
Thank you, through the chair. If I may have a follow up. When you say you need to clarify, do you mean that the bill should be clarifying it, or do you mean that it's somewhere else in statute and maybe should be clarified and not defined? It's not defined well. I'm just trying to better understand practice versus what's in statute and if there is a need for us to have more clarity.
Through the chair, Representative, I misspoke. What I wanted to make sure you was understood that it's not an individual in their home. It's in an institution. So I don't feel that there's any need to clarify additionally in the bill.
Was there Representative Galvin?
Okay, so for my own knowledge, then in an institution, do we mean someone who maybe doesn't have the faculties to be able to use that money? I think of some elders, for example, who may have, let's say, depression. It happens a lot when within our elder population, and while they may have depression, and maybe they're in an assisted living home, because it says public or private institution. I'm just not sure. I want you to please help me with that. If they're in an assisted living home with depression, which I think some might say is a mental disease, given that language, is that the sort of thing which would keep them from enjoying this senior benefits program?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, and home and community-based setting is not considered institutional. It's a community setting. Institution could be a nursing facility or a nursing home. Those are considered institutions.
One more, and this will be it, I promise.
One more, Representative Galvin.
Okay, so that the most popular one here in Alaska, I think, or not most popular, but perhaps the one where most Alaskans live, is a Pioneer Home then. Would that be an example? So the family, or maybe they're getting some other help to pay for the Pioneer Home, or maybe they're paying for it out of their savings or retirement or whatever, and they are in a Pioneer Home, but there is a known some kind of a mental health issue as well. Does that mean they do not receive benefits? That's the question.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, that's very clear that individuals residing in the Alaska Pioneer Home do not receive senior benefits. I don't want to speak to the funding that they're eligible for, but they also receive all of their needs provided within the Pioneer Home, similar to a nursing home.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So through the chair, I'm not sure who can answer. I just had two clarifying questions. So in the sponsor statement I have, it says that it extends it for 8 years, but then you're saying you're removing the sunset totally. Was that an amendment? Or I just want clarification on what the bill does. Which one?
Mr. Succo?
Through the chair, Rep. Colomb, I might have sent the wrong version. I'm so sorry. Oh, okay. This was, it was amended in the Senate Finance Committee. It was originally to extend it another 8 years, as it's been done previous years, but we've amended it to, or I believe it was a CS, to make it an indefinite program.
Great. Okay, and a follow-up?
Follow-up.
My other question is around the program itself. It looks like this bill doesn't change anything about how the allocations are given out. Nothing changes except for that sunset date and removing the longevity bonus wording, correct?
Through the chair, Rep. Colomb, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Staff.
All right, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, Director, through the chair to Director Deb Etheridge. Thank you so much for being before the Finance Committee. So I'm going to have a series of questions here just to walk me through the mechanics of how the program works, if that's okay, Mr. Co-Chair. So first question through the chair to Director Etheridge. I see in my mind when you're giving cash payments out to seniors in these different bracket tiers, how does the mechanic work? Who distributes the payments? How do you determine who? Because the income brackets, I can see in some pro ratings. So walk me through that step, if you could, please.
Ms. Etheridge?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Stapp, a senior or an individual would apply for the benefit very similar to other public assistance programs. There's an application that they can mail in, they can come into our office, and someday soon, hopefully, online, they apply for that benefit. That application is processed by our eligibility technicians. Most, if not all, of our eligibility technicians process all programs for the Division of Public Assistance. They make the determination if they're eligible and at the income level in which they are eligible. They process those cases within our legacy system. It's called EIS, Eligibility Information System. And then if eligible, those payments are made through that system.
Quick follow-up, and then we'll continue, Mr. Co-Chair. So EIS, this is your COBALT system. And are you integrating this program onto your new cloud-based system, or is this going to stick with EIS?
Through the chair, the intention is to move all programs off of our legacy system, the COBALT mainframe system, starting with our Medicaid categories and then working our way through our SNAP and other programs. So it'll be a module, a cloud-based module.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, through the chair to Director Etheridge. Okay, so after it's inputted in EIS and they are approved, who distributes the money? Is that you guys or is that revenue?
Through the chair, Representative, we authorize those benefits through our eligibility information system.
In the distribution through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative, individuals can choose to have their benefits directly deposited. Some cash benefits are issued through our EBT, our benefit card. We have some cash benefits that way. Some benefits can be distributed through a check.
Okay, and final follow-up, and then I'll come around for a second bite of questions later, Mr. Co-Chair. As far as, since they're direct cash payments, are we is revenue issuing 1099s to these individuals like they do the PFD?
Through the chair, Representative, I do not know the answer to that question, so I'll have to get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Also, just so folks know, Marge Stone King with AARP is also on the line. She'll be providing invited testimony. So we'll go to Representative Hannon, Joseph Sintolushevsky, and then maybe we'll go to Marge Stone King and then back for questions again. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Ms. Etheridge, how often does a participant have to redetermine or requalify once qualified?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it's annual reauthorization, renewal of the application.
Okay. Follow-up. Is there anything that would prevent a longer qualification period so that it did not, typically seniors on fixed income don't generally start making more income or go off of a program for assistance as they've aged? Does a statute limit it to a one-year qualification and eligibility, or is there federal regulations? I know that many of our benefit programs, there's federal guidelines on it, or is that within our control in statute or in regulation?
through the chair, representative, that's a regulation that we would have authority to manage.
Thank you, Chair Foster. On a similar note, the benefit level that is paid, how long has it been since we've increased what those monthly payments are?
Through the chair, Representative Hannah, in April 1st, 2024, the poverty level changes, so those eligible changes, but the benefit level has not changed since 2017.
And follow up on that. Is that rate determined via regulation? Or is, if we said, gosh, over the last 7 years, the inflation rate is really high, and we, the poorest of our seniors who 7 years ago got 250, probably need 500, is that something the department can do? Is it via regulation or is it in statute to change that rate?
Through the chair, the rate is in regulation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Etheridge, do you know, and I apologize for not knowing or remembering, did the governor's FY25 operating budget include this $23 million? The law is expired at the end of at the end of the coming fiscal year.
Through Mr. the chair, Hayes. Representative Josephson, it was not included in the budget, and the Senate Finance Committee has taken steps to look at items that will be have attached fiscal notes to address that issue.
All right. So just to clarify, the ARP letter is incorrect where it says it expires next summer. It actually expires this summer. Is that right, Mr. Hayes?
Mr. Hayes?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you are correct.
I don't have any.
Okay, Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, my question is similar to Representative Hannon's. I'm just looking at the fiscal note, and I see you anticipate about a $500,000 increase over the next every year over the next several years, and I guess probably until it stops at one point. I was just curious: is it anticipating just more folks being eligible and coming onto the rolls, or is it actually anticipating a some sort of inflationary increase in the payments per year?
Ms. Etheridge?
Through the chair, Representative, it is a anticipated growth in program participation.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next, we're going to go to Ms. Marge Stone King for invited testimony, and we'll bring it back for questions again. So, Ms. Stone King, if you can put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Chair Foster and members of the committee. My name is Marge Stone King, and I serve as Advocacy Director for AARP Alaska. AARP is a nonpartisan, nonprofit member organization serving the 50-plus population. Our purpose is to empower people to be able to choose how they live as they age. In service to that purpose, AARP has a strong commitment to protecting financial resilience for older adults. And while most of us older adults, older Alaskans are self-supporting, some do need financial assistance to remain independent. Senior safety net programs like the Senior Benefits Program provide foundational support to help low-income elders remain in their homes and out of more costly levels of care. And to give you an example, those who qualify for the largest senior benefit amount of $250 a month can have income of no more than $1,139 per month. And in Alaska, the average Social Security retired worker benefit is $1,485 per month. So these older Alaskans eligible for the senior benefits program fall below that average, which means, of course, that their lifetime earnings were less than average. And what we know about these folks is that the older Alaskans most likely to benefit from an extension of the senior benefits program based on historical participation is women. Historically, senior benefits program beneficiaries have been mostly women. It's no secret that women earn less over the course of their working lives and make up the vast majority of unpaid family caregivers and often outlive their husbands. Lower wage workers, Alaskans who did not make as much during their time working. Many lower paid workers had more than one job, but with Alaska's higher cost of living, we're not able to accumulate much and therefore are more likely to be receiving minimal Social Security benefits. Rural Alaskans, especially those living subsistence lifestyles, less likely to have made cash income. If they receive Social Security at all, their benefits are often very low. And the loss of senior benefits program would hurt many older Alaskans living in our remote villages. And then the oldest Alaskans, our oldest citizens, are the ones most likely to spend increasing amounts of their retirement budgets on health care costs, which may result in financial instability and make it difficult to afford other basic living expenses of housing, food, and heat. Loss of income to this population especially increases risk of losing independence and hastens moves to much more costly levels of care. For these reasons, AARP supports Senate Bill 170 to extend the Alaska Senior Benefits Program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Stone King. We've got a question from Representative Stapp.
I'll just defer just to answer back to the committee, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Stone King, Representative Plum? Okay, I think we've got no questions for you. So thank you very much, Ms. Stone King. We'll go to questions of the committee for our presenters, Representative Staff, and then Clone.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So I will do, I had my second round of thoughts here. First is going to go back to Director Etheridge, the chair. Director, just quick, if you could provide me at some point with how many applications per year for the program, the amount of people who apply versus the total approved per year, and the average processing time of each senior benefit application, if you could, at some point. Those are similar questions I asked to Ms. Enright or other kind of programs within DPA. And my second question through the chair is to Mr. Hayes. So historically, this program, actually, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Hayes. So when I looked at the history of this program, the appropriation basically was vetoed down, or the budgetary amount was, let's call it, shorted based off the total. So the money paid out to the members on this program looks to have been prorated in certain fiscal years. So in the event that the budget doesn't reflect, let's call it this fiscal note in the bill, is that the standard procedure to your knowledge of kind of what happens to the program? It just gets prorated? Through the chair.
And through the chair to Representative Staff, that is correct. It's up to a legislative appropriation each year.
Okay. Next we'll go to Representative Colomb, then Representative Edgman, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. This may be for the director. I was just noticing that the assets don't count as far as their income eligibility, and we know that most seniors don't have like a regular job. So I guess we, sounds like Social Security is counted, but what are some traditional income, like how are they getting, what determines their eligibility? Is investment income, or I guess I'm looking for a definition between assets and income.
Ms. Etheridge.
So through the chair, Representative, to be eligible, you have to be 65 years or older. You have to be within the income level that I think Marge Stone King had represented. and I can give you those various income levels. Mm-hmm. Depending on, you have to be an Alaskan resident, a U.S. citizen or qualified alien. You have to have a social security number or proof that one has been applied for. And then you have to have countable income that doesn't exceed those income limits.
The follow-up.
Follow-up.
So let me clarify. I'm trying to figure out what is the income that you're, what is counting as income if assets aren't included?
Through the chair, representative, I think it's more a definition of asset, which could be a home, a car, a savings account, you know, but that would not be considered income.
But follow-up? But Social Security benefits do count as income?
Through the chair, that is correct. That would be counted as income.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I've got Representative Edgman, Tomaszewski, and staff. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. Just a couple of questions. So we have a bill that's in committee that deals with SNAP benefits. That I'm not sure if there's any sort of interplay between that bill and the public assistance program and the elderly criteria in terms of assets, I think it might be. Are you familiar with the bill, or do you know enough to speak to any sort of connection between those two?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the interplay, I'm not necessarily... Yeah, not necessarily directed. Senior benefits are counted when we're looking at a SNAP benefit level, but no other direct as far as senior, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow.
Sure, Representative Benjamin.
So to follow up on the questions from Representative Loam, exemptions in terms of income. I see permanent fund dividend on the second page of the bill. I'm not quite sure how that ties into program, but in terms of back to the eligibility criteria and exemptions under income, can you speak a little bit to the permanent fund dividend check, for example, Alaska Native regional dividends, things of that nature? Are those counted as income under the federal poverty guidelines?
Through the chair, representative, I'm looking over to make sure they know my answer. There is a statute that requires that the permanent fund dividend cannot negatively, I think, I don't want to quote, I feel like I should do the due diligence to provide you that section about the permanent fund and how it impacts Alaskans' benefits.
And I asked that question, I see Mr. Hayes is about to amplify, yeah. But you know, there's a hold harmless provision, and maybe if you could take that and expand a little bit, please.
Yes,
Mr. Hayes.
Duty chair to Representative Edgman. Yes, it's a whole harmless provision for the Alaska Permanent Fund for folks who get TANF and certain things to not take them off of their whatever benefit they were supposed to receive for that month because of this payment that they received during a certain time of the year. So I do believe the whole harmless provision would also have the same effect for the senior benefits.
If I might.
Representative Edgman.
So, in theory, just given the federal poverty guidelines, and you know, these are low income recipients, mostly women, I think I heard you say a little bit ago, there is probably no snowbirds to take advantage of this program. And maybe I'm asking you a question based more on anecdote than evidence, but it would, in theory, be that. That the beneficiaries of this program are year-round Alaskan residents who make their incomes in the state throughout the entire calendar year.
And Mr. Hayes. Chair, through Representative Edgman, the previous program, the longevity bonus, you had seniors who were snowbirders who were eligible for that funding were able to do that. But with the new program, the senior benefits program, it's really addressing lower fortunate, less fortunate Alaska seniors. And I would make the argument that those folks are not making enough money to be snowbirds.
Representative Benjamin?
Thank you. And that's fairly easy to surmise, I guess one could say. My last question, and again, maybe too broad to provide any kind of definitive response, but it's quite interesting that the numbers see in the handout, in the senior benefits program on page 3, the senior benefit recipients as of December 2023, that, and I'm just thinking of rural Alaska, Mr. Co-Chairman, for the recipients who would get the maximum amount of benefits, $250, there's only 1,917. But I'd be really interesting, maybe at a later time we can talk offline, but to see the demographics involved in these payment tiers, because from my personal experience, a lot of the recipients in the higher level would be in rural Alaska, I would think, but not, you know, entirely, of course. But it'd be interesting to see demographically, with the senior population being the fastest growing segment of Alaska's population, to see how those demographics break down. As a sidebar to this discussion, and I'll close by saying that I'm strongly in support of this. I hope it goes through, and I hope we give our seniors every bit of help they can in an environment, particularly in rural Alaska, where costs are just rising exponentially.
Great. Thank you. And next, let's see, also just for the record, we've got Representative Co-Chair Johnson with us. Next, we have Representative Tomaszewski and then staff. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. A couple of questions, and maybe just to kind of feed off of what Representative Edgerton was talking about. One thing I would think that more women on the program would be, you know, in part that they have a longer lifespan, right? Probably has something to do with it. But a question for snowbirds: how many days out of the state would disqualify them from having this? Is it similar to the PFD? Because I know the PFD has certain amount of days that you can't be gone longer than a certain period of time. Is there anything in this bill that would disqualify them for being out of the state, say, you know, similar to the PFD?
Mr. Hayes?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, that's a very interesting question. I'm not sure. I will defer that to my coworker.
Succo?
Through the chair for the record, Griffin Succo, to Representative Tomaszewski, under Article 1, Chapter 45, Section 47.45.030, after qualification, and this is for the longevity bonus, so this also, I believe, does go with the senior benefits program. After qualification, a recipient shall notify the Commissioner of Health when a recipient expects to be absent from the state if the absence is for a continuous period that exceeds 60 days. After the notification, the recipient may no longer receive bonuses from the Department of Health after the last regularly approved month, application upon returning to the state. The recipient may again make the application for a bonus. Failure to notify the commissioner of an expected absence may ground for disqualification. Apologies.
Thank you, and I get a follow-up.
And
so for fiscal year 2025, we have on here $23,542,000. Do we have that in the budget yet? Or is that something that's going to be added, or where's that money going to come from?
Through the chair, this is Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki, to Representative Tomaszewski. The Senate Finance Committee has looked at the bills, big policy bills that have fiscal notes, and I do believe the Senate Finance Committee has allocated or put aside money to address the senior benefits program.
Sorry, I missed that. Can you say it again real quick?
The Senate has looked at the big policy items that were going to need appropriations, and I do believe they have already put aside money to address this issue for this fiscal year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Edgerton. Was that a question?
Yeah, or you just... a couple of things. One, the $23 million attached to this fiscal note as part of the spending group in House and Senate. So depending on, of course, what happens ultimately through the budget process, it should, you know, presumably the bill has to pass, of course, be part of everything. But it's just interesting to note on Representative Tomaszewski's question that I think the PFD, the Permanent Fund Program, is a 180-day window to be out of state, right? So the 60-day window is more restrictive, and it's just interesting to note. I'm not sure why, if that matters or not. There's a medical exemption, right, for medical care. You know, if you had something, a terminal illness or something that required you to be out of state more than 60 days, but it's just interesting to note because the permanent fund dividend, you look at all the exemptions. Last I looked, it was almost 20. There's the military considerations, things of that nature, whereas this program, far more restrictive. Lots of ups and downs since this thing started in 1972, years that it wasn't funded. You know, talk about the PFD and follow the law. Well, this thing hasn't been funded too for some years as well. So it's a program with a very interesting history. I hope we can resurrect it. The indefinite part goes into law, and it becomes just sort of a regular feature of keeping that fastest growing segment of our population in the state.
Okay, we've got Representative Stapp and then Representative Josephson.
All right, I think Co-Chair Foster gave my third bite at the apple here through the chair. I'll be fairly quick. Regarding exemptions, kind of piggyback on the conversation between Representative Co-Chair Eshman and I think Rep. Colom. Trust income and investment income, is that applicable to the poverty line testing or not? I couldn't find the answer in the statute to, I guess, Director Etheridge or Mr. Hayes.
Through the chair, this is Deb Etheridge, the director for the Division of Public Assistance. Representative Stapp, I need to check what is defined as income when it, to your point. I need to check.
Yeah, thank you. It was actually the co-chair's reference to broad-based category eligibility that made me think of that, because those actually are not included in that definition. So follow-up, Mr. Chair. Co-chair, through the chair, I think this is my last one to Director Etheridge. You talked to earlier about how you loaded the money on the EBT card. How's that work? Is that like a payment in lieu of benefit? Because to me, there's a big difference in being able to just do that and having to cut a paper check to somebody.
Through the chair, Representative, we have a financial management, it's FIS who manages our electronic benefit transactions. And so we authorize that, and then they would issue that benefit based on what we've authorized. It's called FIS is the agency that we use.
Yeah, follow up on this line, Mr. Co-Chair. Okay, through the chair. So the reason I asked the question is because in the description for the ERP, wonderful folks, talk about housing, food, heat, medical care. All those things are separate federal programs, Medicaid, Medicare. All these people are going to qualify for all this stuff if their income is that way. But I don't understand, the EBT card is for SNAP benefits. So how would you load payments that they could in theory spend on other things onto a card for SNAP?
Through the chair, Representative, good question. They actually can tell the transaction type and when you're choosing and what you spend that money on.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
Okay. Representative, is that the...
That's it. I'm done. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, just to clarify, the bill would repeal the 60-day rule in the longevity bonus part of the law, and it retains 4745-304, which seems to restrict absences to medical treatment, the accompanying of a family member to medical treatment, and then it says for a vacation, business trip, or other absence of less than 30 consecutive days, unless the individual's applied for and received a time extension for special circumstances. So that seems to deal with the snowbird issue as well. Does that sound plausible?
Mr. Hayes?
Yes. Through the chair, Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki, to Representative Josephson, I do believe so, yes. Thank
you. Okay, any further questions? I don't see any further questions. So with that, we will set the bill aside. And just looking forward, we will be getting back on track with trying to focus on energy bills. I know there are a lot of bills out there, but we'll be kind of focusing next week on energy. I believe we have one bill that's not energy that was supposed to be heard in the past, and we're going to kind of try to fit that one in there. It's the hard of hearing bill by Representative Allard, I believe on Tuesday, that was supposed to be heard quite some time ago, and so we're going to fit that one in there. But other than that, our next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is on Monday at 1:30, and at that meeting we'll be hearing House Bill 154, that's HFC's Green Bank Bill, and then also House Bill 223, that is Cook Inlet Tax and Gas Royalty Bill. And so with that, if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we will be adjourned at 2:30 p.m. Thanks.